Peace in the Middle East is one of the most continually deferred aspirations in modern human history, a story that's come to be characterized by cycles. As we're recording this, a ceasefire is holding, but being tested, a little more than 2 years after a deadly cross-border attack by Hamas fighters touched off an Israeli incursion and heavy fighting in Gaza. The Monitor's Taylor Luck, based in Amman, Jordan, has reported from the region and helped coordinate coverage of this current phase of the long-running conflict. He is the main contact for Ghada Abdul Fattah, a Palestinian journalist and a Gazan. In Gaza and Israel and beyond, Taylor says he finds shared anguish, but also shared hope. This region wants to move on, he says, to stability and eventual prosperity. This is why we wrote this. I'm Clay Collins. The centerpiece of this episode is a recent interview with Taylor by Krista Case Bryant, the Monitor's editor and former Jerusalem correspondent, among other roles. Both Taylor and Ghada have been guests on this show before. We've pulled together some short segments from other episodes that let them tell more of their stories. Those follow Taylor's conversation with Krista, which was first carried in our daily podcast on October 27th, and that begins again here.
I'm Krista Case Bryant, the editor of the Christian Science Monitor, and I'm joined here this morning by Taylor Luck, our Middle East correspondent. Sabah al-Khair, Taylor.
Sabah al-Noor. Good morning.
So great to have you here with us. And we're just having a conversation here since Taylor's in town. And we just had a really interesting panel out at Principia College for their 25th Monitor Night Live, where four of us spoke about the importance of fairness and trying to get above the fray in this tumultuous news environment. And Taylor, you just shared some things that were so helpful. And one of the things I most appreciated, having been Jerusalem bureau chief myself and wrestled with some of these things during the last Gaza war in 2014, which was, I think, challenging, but not nearly as devastating as what we've seen this time around, is just when we talk about these ideals of journalistic objectivity and the importance of, you know, trying to listen to a wide range of viewpoints and to convey in a fair and respectful way what those viewpoints are, do you ever feel like certain situations can get so severe that those principles need to be put aside in favor of some sort of moral imperative? And how have you thought through that?
Well, thank you, Krista. I think, you know, that kind of pull or feeling of perhaps a sense of moral duty or perhaps a sense of wanting to kind of inject your values into what you do as your job is only human, right? And I think it's important to kind of acknowledge that, and especially in a conflict that's been so perhaps one-sided in terms of civilian deaths, in terms of destruction, in terms of a man-made famine. So I think part of kind of recognizing what I think our role is as kind of neutral referees is to recognize our own feelings, our own perhaps biases and views and our own values. Right now, we're at a period where there's a lot of journalists who see their jobs as activists and as advocates, whether it's domestically in America or in the Middle East. A lot of my colleagues in Gaza who have been under threat of assassination and missile strikes, they see their job as activists, not only telling their people's story, but presenting a viewpoint. And I'm not there to disqualify that, but I think there's a real need for neutral referees kind of calling out, you know, balls and strikes, calling out cynicism when there's cynicism, calling out progress when there's progress. So for me, I found the Gaza war has been the biggest test for me in terms of applying those principles.
And that's saying a lot after how many years in the region? 18?
18 years in the region. Yeah. And I've seen lots of wars, unfortunately, and terrorism and various U.S. involvements in the region. But this has been the toughest. And I think it's been the toughest because civilians have borne the brunt of the conflict. And at the same time, on the Israeli side, which I've also been able to witness firsthand, there's been the plight of the hostage families, which again were civilians that were not involved in conflict. So for me, you know, the one kind of mantra I keep referring to or going back to in my head when covering this conflict is that objectivity is not objectivity when it's easy. It's not when you choose to use it. Objectivity is important when it feels like the darkest hour, where there's no hope, where there's no reward, no witness. And that's when you stick to kind of those principles. So for me, I've had to kind of recognize, you know, my own feelings and my own biases, perhaps, in terms of absorbing all the trauma of the conflict. Being in the Middle East, in the Arab world, you're watching Al Jazeera all the time. So you're seeing images of children dead and dismembered and being pulled from the rubble, for example.
And you mentioned that experience in the barbershop.
Exactly.
Share that.
Yeah, it was a few months into the war, and the owner of the barbershop I go to is Gazan. He lives in Jordan, but his family's from Gaza. And I was there when he received the call that his entire family had been wiped out in a missile strike. And he just shrieked and then collapsed with the news. And I was with people getting those calls constantly, you know. And so it was affecting those around me, that sense of just kind of despair, constant despair. And I had to find a place where I recognize that and I see it and I feel it. But I also went to the other side and saw the kind of the humanity and the despair of the hostage families. And I kind of, you know, with my colleague Rada, who is one of the few Gazan journalists who doesn't see herself as an activist as much as a witness of kind of recording this period of time. And I think she showed great strength in doing that when she herself has been displaced under missile strikes. And together, we've built a body of work where we show the true kind of compilation of the facts without saying, this is how you should feel. And again, a lot of times that will show itself as every single person we interview has lost a close loved one or been displaced a dozen times, or the challenges of finding food or water, showing the nature of the man-made famine in Gaza without shouting that this is where we stand and this is how you should feel. I also keep referring to kind of the idea that we can have multiple truths in a story, even if it's complicated. So for me, you know, two truths that I keep coming up is that on the one hand, this is a conflict that outsizedly affects women and children who are being killed. There's a man-made famine in Gaza. Experts on genocide have deemed Israel's military offensive as a genocide. Another truth is Hamas is still on the ground. They've embedded themselves in civilian populations, and they committed atrocities which sparked the war. And you can have both truths in the same story. And one truth does not negate the other. And on the same hand, that truth does not justify the other. And I think trusting readers that you can have those complicated truths and that they can come away with what they view as the outcome of the conflict or what their values are and how this conflict affects their values, we can trust them to make those conclusions.
Yeah, I think that's so important to be able to look at the complexity, and the closer you get up to the situation, having someone like Rada on the ground to do that is so helpful because, you know, I think she was one of the first journalists to write about how Gazans were starting to protest Hamas and they were frustrated with the way Hamas had provoked the war and was prosecuting the war. And that took a lot of bravery to write a piece like that when Hamas still controls the Gaza Strip. And, you know, you've also talked about, as you noted, you know, Hamas fighting from within civilian areas and how that complicates the way the Israelis respond. And some people will say, well, you shouldn't say that because that just gives the Israelis a pass. But if you don't say it, then it looks like you don't recognize it or you're intentionally hiding things like that. And same thing is true on the other side. So just really appreciate the way you two have worked together to try to provide that complete picture of what's going on.
I think you can apply this to other realms too, like even domestically here in the U.S. Only viewing one side critically but refuse to see the other side critically because you're afraid of giving ammunition or giving space for misleading narratives, then you're not doing your job. I think it's so important to kind of view all sides critically, even if it's lopsided, right? And I think that's one thing that Rad and I work towards, even though it's not the easiest thing.
Yeah. And I want to go back to a point you made earlier on, is just because I think sometimes it can sound contradictory, like I'm all for objective journalism, but I also have biases. You know, it sounds like those two things are in conflict. I remember when I went over to Jerusalem to start that posting, I was thinking, I'm going to talk to people on both sides and be totally fair. And I think sort of thought I was going to be some sort of like neutral robot, you know?
Yeah.
And the more you get to know people, which is so important in our jobs for understanding where people are coming from, and that inevitably leads to friendships and joining them for weddings or for dinners or for their religious holidays or whatever. As you get to know them, like naturally, what they're going through tugs at your heartstrings. And sometimes, you know, for me in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, sometimes that would be on one side and another time on the other side. And it was really important for me to recognize those feelings and that I'm not a robot, I'm a human, and it's right to be compassionate for the people you're dealing with and to have empathy and to have a fuller understanding of what they're going through. And that can make your journalism richer, but it doesn't mean you need to abandon the principle of objectivity. It means you need to come up with ways to discipline your journalistic processes so that you're recognizing you are human, you do have these feelings, you know, but in your work, you're bringing your journalistic toolkit and making sure you're doing everything you can to present that complete view. Even as a human, you're kind of grappling with the toll or the impact.
And I think also, especially with monitored journalism, part of it is we have to tap into our empathy and our sympathy and like recognize that humanity. And I think a lot of our stories, no matter where we're writing from, there's a lot of humanity on the page, and that's us feeling and being channels of empathy between our sources and the reader. So you have to allow yourself to be vulnerable and open enough to kind of take in sources, feelings, and journey to allow readers to take part in that. But then you have to also kind of turn on that you know, professional side where you have to be that rigorous journalist. I think it's always a balance. But also the humanity can anchor a story. So we've done multiple stories where previous ceasefires have broken down and we followed the reactions of Gazans and Israeli hostage families. And it was pretty much they were saying the same thing. They're both in anguish and wanted an end to the war, and they're both disappointed. At the end of, you know, this most recent ceasefire, when it was finally sealed, we spoke to Gazans and Israelis. And it was interesting how the euphoria and joy was different. You know, so for Israelis, it was almost a national celebration. For Gazans, they were still, I don't want to say too broken to heal, but they were perhaps it was too raw and intense for them to feel joy. And so we quoted one woman whose son was alive to see the last ceasefire, but he was killed in between the March ceasefire collapse and the current ceasefire. And I'm going to mess up the quote, but she said that, you know, I cannot feel joy. I cannot feel relief. And so I think by exposing ourselves to those feelings, we can also get across a larger message to our readers. So even in joy, there's an imbalance between Israelis and Palestinians. So it's tough because there's not a switch, right? There's not a switch where you can say, I feel with these people who I'm breaking bread with, living with, spending time with, but now I need to be this objective journalist. But it's a balance. I think we learn, it's weird because there's no real clear line, right? But I think we just learn that now is the time to feel and allow those feelings, and now is the time to be really kind of objective in terms of where does this fit in this wider sphere that we're writing about.
We were talking recently about our founder, Mary Baker Eddy, and the object that she gave us as the monitor, to injure no man, but to bless all mankind, and the incredible love behind that and how she demonstrated that in her own experience, including with a group of rather obnoxious reporters the year before the monitor was founded. And I think it was you who said something to the effect of, we have an unbiased love for all the folks that we cover and for our readers.
It's a love that we share, right? And it's just, it doesn't stop at a boundary or a language or a religion.
Or a political viewpoint.
Or political view, yeah. Right. And I think that's really powerful about our stories and about our journalism. We were talking the other day about how when we speak with people, they really come away with feeling that they've been heard. You know, just the way that we ask questions, the way that we spend time and offer just respect and dignity and grace. I think a lot of our work at times, you know, you're busy dealing with all these crises and events, and sometimes it feels like you're alone. As a reporter on the ground, I'm sure as you felt when you're navigating checkpoints and trying to meet people and things fall through and
definitely
red tape. But when you have this huge family that has your back, it's a pillar of strength.
And the readers are such an important part of that family. So I just want to include them in that as well. And I know so many of them are so grateful for the work that you're doing, and we're grateful for them reading and thinking about these ideas and sharing those with friends and just being part of this journey that we're all on together.
And it's a huge support, because I get a lot of emails from readers. And I think just as we're struggling with some of these subjects and this conflict and this kind of moral issue, so are our readers. And I feel like we're almost kind of sorting this out together on this journey in terms of, you know, how do you see hope and progress in such a brutal conflict? And those emails of support and sometimes just questions and just this kind of mutual exploring of what this means for humanity has been a big part of how I've been able to process.
Will you tell our listeners what you were saying last night about how, before you even start the interview, what you do?
Well, I mean, before I start an interview, I really try to kind of make it feel like it's just a conversation between two people and on an equal plane. So first off, I don't take out my notebook. Right. So if I'm going to interview someone, we sit and we start talking. And first, I'm very gracious. And I say a lot of Arabic phrases, just kind of, you know, saying, may God grant you health. May God make you happy. Thank you so much. And then immediately I share about myself, about who I am and my story. You know, come from the Midwest. I've lived in the Mideast for 18 years. I'm American, but I'm also Muslim. But I also work for a newspaper that was founded by a church and kind of share a bit about myself. And then we just talk, you know, not an interview. I'm not recording notes. And we'll have a 15, 20 minute talk. I share before I press someone to share with me. And then we have a conversation just like between two people. There's no dynamic of me trying to take information or an interrogation. And then we just have this lovely chat as two people meeting and kind of connecting. I share about the Madras focus on values and the importance of humanity and the importance of looking at how other people see the world, that we're not coming here with a lens of we want to just take something real quick and support a thesis we already have or a political viewpoint. We don't have advertisers that are pressing us to do things a certain way. And so when I kind of explain that framework and explain some of the stories that we do, people feel like more relaxed, you know, more at ease, and they get it. You know, they get the monitor way of journalism even before they see a story. And then when we start asking questions, we're asking questions they've never really been asked of before, like, how do you see this event? Or how did this event make you view, you know, perhaps the larger issue of trust or fairness or even hope? And so I think the combination of our mission, the way we ask questions, it kind of makes people walk away feeling that they've been respected and that their fellow humanity has been kind of recognized. And I don't think many people going away from interviews with other journalists necessarily feel that.
That's wonderful. Well, thanks so much for your work in the field for us.
Well, thank you so much for your support from one Middle East journalist to another. I really appreciate having someone with that background giving me full support.
So let's roll it back. Readers have asked how Taylor got his start on his beat. Here's what he told us in late 2019.
I didn't set out to be a journalist. I didn't even study journalism. You know, but I studied international relations in college. I knew I wanted to do something either in diplomacy or something in international relations. I wanted to learn Arabic. We didn't have Arabic at my school. And on graduation, I was like, okay, well, let me go try to learn some Arabic. And basically, as silly as this sounds, looked at a map and looked at the region, and Jordan made the most sense geographically because it's right in the middle. And linguistically, it's kind of right in the middle. But so I went out to Jordan and I got a job at the English newspaper there called the Jordan Times. And what made it perfect was the fact that it was all Jordanians. I mean, all my colleagues, and it was attached to an Arabic-speaking newspaper called Al Ra'i newspaper. So literally all our conversations were in Arabic, all our editorial discussions were in Arabic, the interviews were in Arabic. So I was kind of just put on the spot. Like, you just had to speak it, you know, sink or swim. You know, but what made the whole experience special was that, you know, I wasn't there to advance my career. I was just there to learn and listen. And more than just learning from the people, I was living with the people. You know, they have a saying in Arabic, "Kun bayna khubzu millah aw aishu millah," which means we have broken bread or salt. So, you know, when the important daily rituals were just sitting around having meals, relaxing and talking. So for me, literally, I just hopped out from the Midwest to the Mideast with an open heart and open mind, and here I am today.
Taylor would become deeply immersed in the Middle East using language proficiency to gain cultural fluidity and respect. He would travel widely. Taylor has gone particularly deep on Tunisia in North Africa, but the Israeli-Palestinian conflict would, of course, keep drawing him in.
It's been a privilege to work with Aveda, and she's been not only our eyes and ears on the ground, but also our heart on the ground, kind of guiding our stories. At the beginning, I always was afraid that I'm bothering Aveda while she's in the middle of field reporting or dealing with issues at home, or avoiding missile strikes, and I'm messenger about where are the photo caps, or I have a question on this part. So I always felt a little bit intrusive. I don't know if it's going to be a good time to call. I don't know if the bandwidth will be good enough to send voice messages. So we just have this ongoing chat about what is going on, sending each other updates. And, you know, sometimes there are events where neither of us have the words. Whether it's an evacuation of all of Rafah or if it's a destruction of another hospital. But Ghada has been kind of my guide through all this difficult emotions that we have to ride through, I think, every single day. For me, it's not even 1% of what she faces. But the fact that we're able to have this ongoing, nonstop conversation from morning to night, for me, it helps me process.
For her part, Chada says she benefited from Taylor's perspectives, which helped her explore angles that she herself might be too close to see. Here's Chada from that same podcast episode last year.
As the war escalated, I started to realize that the humanitarian crisis was more severe than we all anticipated, and the emotional toll on myself and on the community that I belong to and on the beloved people was very profound. I started to center my writing and my reporting around human stories and capturing the lived experiences of those who are affected by this war. And I felt that this approach is trying to connect the community and the people who are affected with the numbers. Not having international journalists allowed to enter Gaza is making it more challenging for us, because I feel sometimes it's a huge responsibility. I always think of and see and look for the very minute details that are happening around me. And I always ask myself, what if Taylor, for example, see this specific event, how would he report on this? And what if he, for example, see this story, how would he report on this specific story? Sometimes we get a sense of normalcy for the events around us, but it's not normal. So it's always important to kind of defamiliarize the events that are happening around us, to just think, is this something that is familiar for international readers, or is it something common for people?
Taylor's reporting always seems to have at its roots some of that sense of universal experience, of yearning, for example. In 2022, he spoke on this show about a slow transformation in Saudi Arabia. This small anecdote really illustrates his openness to letting parts of stories find him.
When I was leaving the town of Abha, which is a town in the mountains, I was waiting at the airport to fly to Riyadh. And while I was sitting in the cafe in the airport, there were two younger women in their mid-20s, and they were working on laptops waiting for their budget flight back to Riyadh. And so we struck up a conversation, and they said that they were just, you know, they live and work in Riyadh, and normally they would take vacations outside Saudi Arabia with their families. But since the changes, they were able to take, you know, a girls' weekend out just to kind of let off steam in Abha, in this very green and misty town. 4 or 5 years ago, it was illegal for women to travel on their own without a male guardian. And the airports themselves used to be gender segregated. So the fact that these two women are just hanging out and taking a few selfie pics at the tarmac before they got on the plane like it was nothing, and the fact that no one in the airport batted an eye, that's pretty cool. But all of a sudden, when we're talking about transformations, that is the transformation. It's not about the dollars and the cents and the new gleaming skyscrapers that might be built. They became the story.
Stories of transformation come with setbacks, of course, sometimes big ones. In July 2023, on one of Taylor's earlier visits to the Monitor studio, I asked him about how his region's old rifts, secular and religious, just seem to keep stealing away opportunities for what all people want, self-determination and prosperity by some measure. I asked him then what signs he sees that the arc still somehow bends toward those things, about what evidence he sees of credible hope.
I definitely believe the arc bends towards progress, eventually, because people at their hearts want a better life for themselves and a better life for their community. Oftentimes, it's the dictators, it's the far-right politicians, it's the demagogues who are stirring up these reactive forces, trying to appeal to our worst natures, because if there is change or progress in any sector, they see that as an eventual threat to them. But despite this, I find across the Middle East, young people are finding a way. Politically, the avenues are closed for now, but I'm finding young people across all these countries finding local issues and advocating for solutions. For example, I've met young people who have developed rainwater catchment systems and cheap ways to dig wells to improve water availability for Jordanians. I've met young people who have come up with solutions to combat desertification in Tunisia. So one thing that's kind of been fascinating what these young people have done, they've said basically, okay, we can't talk about democracy because we know we will be put in jail before we finish posting our next Facebook post. But what they've done is they've tied these local community issues to the national strategies of these countries to make it even harder for these regimes to shut them down. You know, tying something into food security, tying something into energy, tying something into women's empowerment. And so they're finding their own little ways to make change and biding their time until perhaps changes on the ground could eventually turn into political change. You know, they say where there's a will, there's a way. But I find, you know, with these young people, where there's hope, there's a way.
Thanks to our listeners. You can find show notes with links to full episodes we excerpted here, including ones hosted by Samantha Liney Purfas, Ken Kaplan, Amelia Newcomb, and me at csmonitor.com/whywewrotethis. This episode was hosted by me, Clay Collins, and produced by Mackenzie Farkas. Jingnan Peng is also a producer on the show. Our sound engineer for this mashup was Alyssa Britton. Original music is by Noel Flatt. Produced by the Christian Science Monitor, copyright 2025.